And with the look at conditions in the backcountry, I have Mark from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Well, as you know, with the warm weather, that's definitely going to affect the snow. It's been solidly refrozen the past few days. The danger's been low, but today, as things really start to heat up, danger will rise to moderate. We're definitely going to see some loose sweat avalanches, and they may grow larger in the coming days as things really get warm, depending on how things refreeze at night. But for today, the danger will be moderate, and just watch out if you're in any confined terrain like a gully or couloir where wet loose avalanche debris can pile up deeply.
Okay, Mark, thanks. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Council member Chris Robinson, Park City School District Chief Academic Officer Amy Hunt talking about student assessment, the achievement gap, and how funds coming from the American Rescue Plan will help address kids who need extra support getting caught up. Then Mountain Mediation Center is holding another community conversation April 6th. They'll be telling us about where and how people can participate. Well, the state of Utah is lifting the mask mandate as of April 10th. With that, the Summit County Council yesterday considered whether to extend a limited mask order locally beyond that date. Following a recommendation from County Health Director Rich Bullo, council members decided against the extension. As KPCW's Rick Bruff reports, they did talk about supporting local businesses that will voluntarily continue a mask requirement.
Health Director Rich Bullo told council members that COVID-19 case numbers have been decreasing in Summit County and across the country. He said two major reasons for that are vaccinations and citizens following basic precautions, including masking. In declining to call for a continued mask order, Bullo noted they called for masking in the first place for two objectives, ensuring hospital capacity wouldn't be maxed out and protecting elderly at-risk patients. He said those two goals have largely been accomplished. Also, after April 10th, the mask order would be limited in scope, as dictated by new legislation, HB 294. Deputy County Attorney Dave Thomas explained that the council could enact a local health order which would require masks just in cases where 50 or more people gathered who were not socially distanced. However, Thomas reported that such a health order must be rescinded if three metrics are met. That is, the state's 14-day case rate would be less than 191 per 100,000 population. The 7-day average for ICU utilizations is less than 15%. And over 1.6 million doses of vaccines have been allocated to the state. Bullo said those metrics have been met, or they expect they will be, in the state by mid-May. One other exception is that public schools have the prerogative to set and continue their own health orders until July 1st. Meanwhile, Bullo said that in a recent Park City Chamber Bureau survey, 68% of responding businesses favored extending a mask order, and 72% said they would require masks regardless of what the state or county does. Bullo said the county should use its resources to support businesses that continue mask mandates.
Rather, we would take the resources that we would utilize to both implement and manage that order to support businesses, to help businesses message, to provide masks where needed for their employees if they wish to go down that road. We can help support signage. We can coordinate community activities, positive messages to try to make sure that not just the residents of Summit County and the people who live here, but also our visitors understand that we need to protect each other.
He said citizens should be civil. He urged them not to shame people for wearing a mask or for not wearing one. Bullo said there's still indicators to watch. He said the current cases are being driven by young children and the UK variant is appearing in those cases. He said we're not out of it yet.
You know, I want to be really clear. This is not over. The variants changed the equation. I just mentioned that kids are being infected. We need to get a handle on that. I think our contact tracers and case investigators right now are doing quite well with that. But who knows what happens in the future. So we still need to be responsible.
County Health Director Rich Bullo, who added that the best way to get back to normal is to have a significant number of people vaccinated. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
The council yesterday also heard from a lineup of speakers during public input that are still upset with county officials. They bashed the mask mandates, the promotion of vaccines, and said that COVID restrictions have taken a toll on citizens over the past year. Some 13 speakers during public comment, virtually all criticizing the COVID restrictions of the past year. On the phone now with me, I have Summit County Councilmember Chris Robinson. Good morning.
Hi, Leslie.
So what do you think of the council's consensus to not go ahead with a limited mask order?
Well, I think it was wise. You know, that House Bill 294 put pretty strong boundaries on what happens after April 10th, and I like the approach of using our resources to help educate and help the businesses that want to continue, which is their prerogative, provide them with masks or signage, and try to spend our time in getting as many vaccines and as many arms as we can and spend those resources that way. I think that's more productive. I thought it was a good call.
Yeah. So the critics who spoke up during public input yesterday seemed to have three basic complaints. One, that the masks are violating civil rights and that there's some data questioning whether that they work to prevent spread. There were also questions about the safety of the vaccines. And then a third complaint seemed to be that the COVID restrictions have created a serious toll on the mental health of our citizens, especially our children. So what's your reaction to their concerns?
Well, first of all, I work for them and the rest of the public, and we'd like to hear from our constituents, even though maybe we were a little short-tempered with some of them yesterday. And I think they represent those that spoke a very small subset of the community. I think, you know, on the flip side of that, we had many people concerned that we weren't rolling vaccines out fast enough and wanting to get vaccinated. I have my turn today for my first dose. I'm looking forward to it. I think that we received emails from many of those that spoke and many more saying don't extend the mask mandate. So we didn't extend it, not because of them, but I mean, because of a combination of factors, and there were some pent-up emotions, and we had a platform there for them to share that, and that's what makes this a great country, is people can have and share opinions. I think that wearing the mask is a good thing. I'm going to continue to do so for a while until even after the mandate. I'm going to get vaccinated. I believe that all of us have experienced, including myself, some mental anguish at times. This has not been an easy year plus, and I'm sympathetic to that and to those that have suffered in their businesses and their kids in their trying to get an education. But I think in the big picture, the steps we've taken and that the state has taken and that the nation has taken are the right ones to encourage social distancing and encourage your mandate mask wearing. It's a small sacrifice. I believe it has slowed the spread. And now I think the modern miracles of modern science have, well, not fully FDA tested, but with this emergency authorization for use authorization, have come up with some vaccines that make a real difference. So, in the big picture, I just summarize by saying we love to hear from the public. We had 177 people on the Zoom call yesterday. They maybe not were all there for that matter because we had another matter, but it was good. It gave them a chance to be heard, and it gave us a chance to do what I think was the right thing.
Yeah, certainly the majority of the comments that you heard showed opposition to wearing the mask. But locally, I mean, do you have some sense? I mean, is there more support or opposition to wearing masks?
I think the business community believes in it. They have people, employees that are forced more than I am, sequestered here in my home office to interact with people. You want to protect them. And so, as was mentioned in the Chamber Bureau study, where some 60-70% wanted it to continue, I think there's that side. I think in general, I've been very appreciative as I get around the county to see the level of mask wearing. I think that the citizens accepted it. And now maybe, you know, we're all getting tired of it, but it's a small sacrifice, I think. And I think they're, for the most part, accepting that. Those that attended yesterday, I think, may have been rallied through some organizing to come up and speak their piece. But I don't believe they represent anywhere near the majority.
All right. Other issues. The Wiloway Ranch appeal was postponed. How come? Didn't get through the 850 pages?
It wasn't due to us. There was an ask by the county attorney's office to extend because the minutes from the previous meeting weren't complete and there wasn't time to finish some other report. And so there was a petition to us in our quasi-judicial capacity to extend, and the other side consented to it with the hope that it wouldn't be too long. And so it'll be hopefully rescheduled in the near future.
All right. And then the code amendments on the accessory buildings, and council did not make a decision. Is that part of, though, the Wiloway Ranch appeal, though? I mean, given that that is an accessory building that's being proposed?
Well, as was said in the meeting, this ordinance, proposed ordinance, is not about any specific project. The Wiloway Ranch is one example of perhaps a relatively small parcel having a relatively large accessory building, but it would be unaffected by whatever we decide because it had been through the process and has a vested application. It's grandfathered. This new ordinance would not be retroactive to it. But there's been a sense for many, in my tenure on the council, many years back, there's been anecdotally concerns over some of these large lots in Old Ranch Road or in Silver Creek becoming the homes for very large structures with very little oversight. That up to 10,000 feet with just a limited impact permit, and above that with a conditional use permit, which have to be granted if the impacts can be mitigated, based on conditions. And so there's a concern that it's unbounded, and so we passed a temporary ordinance, six-month moratorium, basically, so we could study this. And so that was on the 10th of March. 3 weeks later, last night, we have this proposed ordinance that had worked its way up through the Planning Commission. To me, it was premature. We got lots of more time to study it, and it's a big deal, and we want to get it right. And
will you be holding another public hearing on it, on accessory buildings?
Well, we quote unquote closed the public hearing, and I don't know. I would hope we'd take more public comment, whether or not procedurally it can be a reopening of the official public hearing. I don't know, but I would like to hear more from the public. And if you listened in last night, I encouraged the staff to get us more information on a handful of the most egregious examples, and let's study what the problem is, and then let's craft an ordinance to fix it.
All right. As you mentioned, I mean, we're seeing issues along Old Ranch Road as well as Silver Creek. Silver Creek was developed I believe Old Ranch Road, I mean, as a kind of an equestrian lifestyle there, which, there were some comments I have seen where people feel like we are doing away with the equestrian nature of Silver Creek as new people move into the area, that they're not interested in the equestrian lifestyle. I mean, they don't want to see more of it. So how do we balance those wants out?
Well, I don't think that I think it, as my colleague Doug Clyde said, there isn't a scintilla of a particle of any of the council that's anti-equestrian or anti-horse raising and using. I don't really think that's the driver here. I think the egregious offenses in some people's minds, and I haven't seen them. That's why I want more information. But anecdotally, they are large buildings that are sometimes on a relatively small lot and that are used for other things. There's been discussions of, you know, hockey rinks and more commercial type uses, and that once they get built, they're unregulated. You know, how it's so-called riding arena today, and then it's in some other big use, commercial use tomorrow, that slips under the radar. But I don't think there's any intent to legislate out horses in Old Ranch Road or Silver Creek. They're beloved parts of our heritage, and while everyone may not enjoy riding them, they are enjoyed as part of the culture. So it's not about that.
So
it's more. Go ahead.
I was just going to say. So do we need to define it, though? I mean, just a building size per acre, so that don't see these large buildings overwhelming smaller parcels.
Well, that's sort of what the ordinance was. It said if you have. It had a graduated tier. I'm just going from memory, but if your parcel was, this is for the major accessory building, there were a minor accessory, but if your parcel were 5 acres and greater, you could have 12,500 square feet. If it was 4 to 5 acres, you could have 10,000. If it was 3 to 4 acres, you could have 7,500 or something. And to me, those are, especially on the upper end, those are very small percentage utilization. I pointed out that on a 5 acre parcel, 12,500 square feet is 5.6% of the area. And if you had a 10 acre parcel, it would only be 3%, say, of the area. And I think there are other ways to deal with some of that by setbacks and other conditions, rather than, say, if you have a 10-acre parcel, you can only use 3% of it. And because some people, including myself, although I haven't had the means or the ambition to do it, I have a 15-acre parcel here on Old Ranch Road, and I haven't built anything other than the house. But some people might, with that kind of space, might want some accessory buildings where they can store their toys and where they could, have greenhouses and a barn and other things. And it can be done in a way that's not inimical to their neighbors. But right now there's no borders on it. There's no upper limit. And the setbacks are minor, you know, like 12 feet or something. I don't know. It's 10, 12 feet. You could have a huge building 10 feet from your neighbor could build a huge building 10 feet from your property line.
So again, when does this come back to council?
Oh, it's hard to predict. In the next few weeks, we have, you know, a lot on our plate, and it'll surface soon.
All right. Monday's meeting with Representative Blake Moore. How did you feel about meeting your colleagues in person after a year?
Well, it was nice. I hadn't even been in the Richens building other than to drop a ballot off in months and months, and it was great to see everybody. I thought the meeting with Representative Blake Moore was refreshing. He said he wanted to be productive and not hyper-partisan, which is the phrase that sticks out in my mind. Which means, and he's devoted a lot of effort to get into the district and meet people. And I've had, this is like the fourth or fifth meeting, first one in, or second one in person that I've had with him. But he wants to be a problem solver. We gave him some very specific ideas of things immediately that he could help us with, mainly with transportation. And I think he's smart and has an open mind and wants to make things happen. So I thought it was very positive.
Yeah. And any agenda items in particular that you'd like him to help with?
Well, we have a lot of heavy lifts on our bus rapid transit. You know, we've applied several years for this build grant to have a dedicated lane on both sides at 224. We have the Kimball Junction improvements. And the legislature approved money to include that Kimball Junction interchange project in for the EIS, the beginning of the NEPA work on it. It's going to be a need for a lot of work there. Those are the main kinds of things we have with our new High Valley Transit. We have a couple of small asks on some buses and things, but there'll be more, but we wanted to leave him with something concrete he could take home and go to work on.
Okay. Hey, I just wanted to ask you, I know you're not up for a re-election to the council until 2022, but you've been on the council since 2008. Are you ready to let us know what you're thinking in another year or so that others maybe could start thinking about their election opportunities?
I haven't figured that out exactly, but I do think 14 years is a pretty fair period of time.
Okay. I'm going to leave it at there. Chris, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Summit County Council member Chris Robinson. Well, the Park City School District has nearly made it through the school year with only 2 weeks where the high school and middle school was, or junior high school was taken to remote learning. That after Christmas due to an outbreak of COVID. Schools were closed down last spring before any sort of student assessment could be completed. On the phone now with a look at how students are doing academically, I have the district's chief academic officer, Amy Hunt. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So I think it was in 2019 when the state of Utah had a problem with the RISE student testing program. Then last spring, schools closed before students could be assessed, and the state legislature agreed that that didn't need to happen. So what's the plan for this spring? Are we going forward with student testing?
Yes, so the state will be having the testing. We actually have been doing some piloting, making sure that our computer systems work for that computerized test. So we've done a couple of dry runs, and our juniors have completed the ACT, which is the standardized test that they take in the 11th grade. So we are excited to be able to have that summative assessment. It's interesting, you know, we do different kinds of assessments during the year. So we typically will use different kinds of data points during the year to see how our students do, but we appreciate those summative exams because they tell us at the end of a year how much have our students grown during that year.
Sure. So are we back to using that RISE company?
So the state contracted somebody differently for 2019, and that was when they experienced some of the struggles they had that year. They went back to the vendor that they were using previously. So the 2018 vendor that they knew and had success with is the vendor that they're using this year.
Yeah. And as you know, student testing is so controversial. Teachers say it just takes away from teaching. There's also the argument that it just pits school district against school district. Others say that teachers then just teach to the test. I mean, is there a case to be made that we don't need this additional testing and that in-class testing is all we really need to know about how students are performing?
You know, I think it's important to have different kinds of measures to understand student learning. I think one of the things that we focus on here in Park City is that there's assessment for learning and then there's assessment of learning. Assessment for learning looks like those things that we do along the way to determine whether or not our students are being successful with the information they're learning at that moment. And the assessment of learning helps us to be able to see over time, are students able to retain the things that they're learning? are they learning them deeply enough that a year from now they still remember those concepts and can apply them in their, you know, progression of learning? So I think they're all important. Whether or not they all always measure exactly where a student is difficult because, you know, when we say that we're focusing on the whole child, we're focusing on more than just their academic mastery, but also the ability they have with competencies that we know are going to be things that they'll need for their entire lifetime to be able to be successful in their, you know, career and their life beyond, you know, our high school or their college. So I think that there's a lot that goes into thinking about what and how do we determine whether or not a child is being successful. And I think we have to think of those large high stakes exams as being only one measure of a student's growth and success.
Yeah. So when would we get the results of the spring testing?
You know, they don't give us an actual time frame. I think that they've moved to a different vendor with the hope of being able to have those scores before we go into school this fall. So we don't have an exact date that they'll say that we have them by, but I think that the likelihood is that we'll have them before we move into school next fall.
All right. We were getting closer to narrowing the achievement gap before all of this happened. Do we have data to see what that challenge is at this point?
Yeah. So, Leslie, it was really interesting. As I said, we have some other measures that we use during the school year, and particularly for our younger students who are, you know, at those phases in their education where they're learning to read or they're learning number concepts. And so for those students, we noticed that when we did our beginning of the year testing, many of our children were behind where they typically are as they begin the school year in that grade level. And that had us really worried. So we really shifted the way that we do some of our interventions and support. And instead of trying to just focus on students that were struggling, we focused on those students that were struggling, but also pushed into classrooms and provided additional practice and support for things that we knew weren't taught in person during the spring. So when we did our middle of the year assessments, I was really delighted to see that our kids are back at the level that they typically are for middle of the year when we look at our cohort data over time. What that speaks to me is to the resiliency of our students and even more to the talent and ability of our teachers to be able to take kids not only and help them grow as they normally do, but to take them from a place of deficit and pull them to where they typically are at this time of the year is really quite tremendous. I think the big challenge for us is to be able to continue that growth because, you know, ultimately we want kids to do more than just grow where they normally do. We want them to grow beyond that. So we're taking these practices that we've seen during this COVID time where we've been really had the opportunity to think differently about how and what we do. And we definitely are going to keep those practices that we now know are going to make a difference.
Yeah. So who's doing that work, that additional help by pulling kids maybe out of the regular setting to help them move ahead?
Yeah, Park City has always had different types of intervention work in place. In our district right now, we have several teacher support positions that are more like teacher leader positions that our teachers, some of our most experienced teachers, and they fit the role of an interventionist. And so they are working both with students who need tier 2 and 3 support. They're a year behind in school or greater. But they also are working with our teachers in their professional learning communities and talking about how to take that first lesson when we're introducing concepts or supporting concepts for students and make it very accessible for students in the room. So it's a lot of work on the planning beforehand to make sure that those students who need an additional challenge have work given to them or presented to them at their level at the same time that we are, you know, making it accessible for students who may not have that comprehension at the time. And that takes an awful lot of planning. And that's what our interventionists and our instructional coaches are doing, is both helping those students who need additional support, but pushing in and really helping our teachers plan and be able to deliver inclusive and accessible lessons from the beginning.
Yeah. Have Have you been able to kind of see who or what cohort has been most affected academically? I mean, is it more in the elementary school versus the secondary schools? I mean, is it our Title I kids or is it our English language learners?
You know, interestingly, some of the statistics that we've run, our big question was, is there a significant difference between our remote learners and those who were coming to school this year? We haven't really seen that. We've seen they're performing about the same. So that's good. That means to us that a lot of the time and energy that we invested in trying to help our remote learners, particularly at the youngest levels, be able to participate in robust learning, that we were able to accomplish that. We have noticed that traditionally students who are learning to speak English have a more difficult time accessing, opportunities in those first lessons. And some of those strategies we're using right now really are making a difference with those students. So those are practices we're going to continue to keep. We are going to utilize some ESSER funds. The ESSER is the money that is already in place that has been provided down through the federal government into the state to deal with students that are at risk or that have experienced struggle during COVID-19. We will be using some of that funding to have some really targeted summer opportunities for students. We recognize that it's difficult to go to school all year long for some students. So we're going to mix that targeted academic opportunity time with some nice outdoor experiences in the afternoon with some of our community partners. And we're really looking forward to having that targeted time with those kids in smaller groups, really focusing on their point of need, but then giving them an opportunity to experience some things in the afternoon that will, uplift and provide some social and emotional learning as well. So summer school will be held throughout June and part of July, and we are having an elementary program at McPolin, and we'll be having an opportunity all the way up through 8th grade at Treasure Mountain Junior High. And then the high school is also doing some targeted support for students who need to do some credit recovery or need some additional support over the summer.
All right. So I've seen several ads in the local newspaper. I mean, we're hiring people at $10 an hour. Are these just folks maybe on the playground, or are these...
Some are supervisory types of assignments. We are serving lunch. We are doing, outdoor activities. So that may be the position that you're talking about. Our teachers primarily come from our pool of teachers who teach during the school year, and they're paid at the rate that is part of their contractual rate. So I think the $10 is the contractual rate for those additional support that we bring in during the summer.
All right. And could those be like high school students then looking for a summer job?
I don't know. I think there is an age requirement, and they would have to have a background check. I don't know that we would want to particularly hire a student, at least to support a like student of like age, if that makes sense. So we probably wouldn't hire a high school student to do high school or junior high. But if they meet all the requirements and the background check and are at least 18 years of age, I would assume they would be considered for the younger students.
All right. And then in terms of the American Recovery Act money, does the district have a say in how that money is spent?
We always have some local control because it seems that Utah prioritizes the opportunity for school districts to be able to do that. What happened with the ESSER money is that it does get filtered through the legislature, and the legislature here in Utah did provide some pretty strict guidelines to inform schools of how the money should be spent, especially with consideration of what those federal requirements are. I don't know what that will look like for this round of money, but I do believe that there will be some guidelines around making sure that the money is spent primarily on students. We're hopeful that they will also allow for some expenditures that most school districts have incurred around purchasing additional supplies or, changing air filtration systems and really having to utilize some funding to be able to make our schools a better place for us to be able to mitigate the risk of virus during COVID-19.
Okay, and I know that some of that money was to provide Wi-Fi for students. Where are we with providing Wi-Fi access for all kids?
Yeah, so one of the things that we did early on when we first realized that our schools were going to be in soft closure was we went with our we have a position called an outreach coordinator, which is at each site supporting families that have, you know, community needs beyond just academic needs. And we went with those community outreach people to all of our families that indicated they did not have internet services. And we immediately worked with T-Mobile to get hotspots in all of those areas. We continue to poll our community and, you know, let people know that if they don't have Wi-Fi, please to let us know, because we can immediately work with them to get a hotspot in right in their home so that they can use the technology that we're providing for them.
Okay. Let's see. Anything else you wanted to mention? Oh, I wanted to ask you about AP testing. Our exams will be offered this year? I don't think they were last year.
Last year they were offered in an electronic basis, and not every exam was offered. This year, AP has let us know that they will be having traditional testing, although the way that kids test will probably look different in terms of scheduling and where and when, simply so that we can maintain physical distancing.
Okay. Anything else?
Yeah, I did want to just thank our community. You know, it takes all of us together to really get through some of these difficult times. And our parents have been tremendous. And our community partners, you know, even our Park City Education Foundation has stepped forward and really worked with our teachers to try to provide additional support for their wellness. The stress and strain that's been on them is tremendous. But as I said before, they've been so resilient and really remain student-centered and focused, and have been able to work with students even when it felt like it was going to be an impossible task. So, you know, we owe a debt of gratitude to the many, many people that are really helping us make sure that we're moving forward and really continuing to provide that rigorous academic program that Park City has for its students, and to help us do it well. So, you know, sometimes we don't get avenues or events to be able to thank our community, especially at a time where we're trying to keep as many people that aren't regularly in schools away from schools. I just felt like this was a great time, Leslie, to be able to just express that thanks.
Okay. Amy, I appreciate your time this morning. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Amy Hunt is the Chief Academic Officer for the Park City School District. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, the Mountain Mediation Center continues to facilitate community conversations. On the phone with details from Mountain Mediation Center, I have Chris Campbell and Joanna Acevedo. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So, Chris, do you want to start and just let us know when and where this conversation is happening?
Sure. So we're having a conversation on Tuesday, April 6th from 6:30 to 7:45 p.m. It will be a virtual Zoom meeting. We hope to be able to do these in person again soon, but for now we're having the conversations on Zoom. We have an RSVP registration form and a Zoom link that can be found. Joanna, do you have details on where we can find the links?
Yeah, it can be found on our social media pages. On Instagram is Mountain Mediation Center, and so it's also on Facebook, and we have links directly to our RSVP form and our Zoom.
Okay, so why do you think that these are important to host like this?
So our mission is to really find ways that people with differing viewpoints can listen to each other with understanding and mutual respect, and it's particularly challenging in this COVID time to have conversations with people with differing viewpoints and to meet people. So we're finding that this Zoom format gives us a chance to interact safely. And people have really appreciated in the series that we've had so far this year, have really appreciated the opportunity to meet new people that they wouldn't have been able to otherwise talk with.
All right. And this conversation, Joanna, is about what?
This conversation focuses on how folks have become involved in the community decisions, and, well, their local community decisions. It can be in organizations, in schools, in their local government, and we want to get a better understanding as to what interests folks and what gets them, like, more involved, and then maybe some of the barriers that have prevented folks from becoming involved. So we would just want to get a better understanding of where people are at, so that we can see what resources they're looking for in order to get involved.
All right. And Chris, do we have somebody kind of mediating the discussion?
So these discussions work. We break into small groups in the Zoom, 10 to 15 people, and each small group is facilitated by one of our trained facilitators. I'll be one of those facilitators. We have several people trained. We also have Spanish interpreters, so each group will have a Spanish interpreter so that we can have these conversations bilingually.
Okay. I know that you've done some of the conversations specifically in Spanish, but this will be kind of a bilingual opportunity?
Correct, yeah. We actually had the previous one also be a bilingual conversation, and it went really well, and we are very much looking forward to having this one be a bilingual opportunity so that if more voices can be heard and we can get different perspectives.
Okay. And what do you think people can get out of this by attending the April 6th conversation?
So it gives people a chance to speak up. It also gives people a chance to listen and hear from others in their community, find out what other people are doing, get some perspectives from a variety of people.
And anything you wanted to add, Joanna?
I think it's just a really great learning opportunity for all the folks involved, like including us and including those around us. It's a really great way to just see maybe like some of the barriers that have come up for folks, or maybe some of the big interests of the community.
Okay. So anything else you guys want to tell us about this?
We just think that having an active people participating in the community leads to a vibrant, healthier community. So we're hoping that these conversations are easy ways for people to start to become more active if they want to, or to learn how, or to get support in a safe space. You know, we work really hard to ensure that everybody has a chance to speak comfortably and safely in this environment. So.
Okay. All right. Again, that's happening April 6th, and people can go to, I think, mountainmediationcenter.org for more information then?
Correct.
Okay.
And our social media pages as well.
Okay. Joanna and Chris, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
Well, as we reported earlier, Summit County Council members on Wednesday decided that they don't want to extend a limited mask order after the state's mask mandate expires April 10th. Despite that, a lineup of speakers during public input still upset with county officials. They bashed mask mandates and the promotion of vaccines and said that COVID restrictions have taken a toll on citizens over the past year. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more.
Council members generally agreed with Health Director Rich Bullo that they won't enact a new mask order, but they want to support business owners who still require masking, along with their employees who might be apprehensive about working around maskless customers. Of the 13 speakers in public comment, virtually all criticized the COVID restrictions of the past year. Elizabeth Smith said she's been a registered nurse for 11 years and has two children.
Over the course of the last year, I have watched my happy, energetic, carefree children develop signs of depression, fear, and anxiety, including threats to take their own life. They describe masks as embarrassing and hot and hard to breathe in. They have a hard time understanding what people are trying to say to them under a mask. They cannot make out emotions or expressions from underneath a mask. My children are literally afraid to go to school out of fear of masks on their face and because everyone around them is wearing one. I have been unable to provide them the help they need due to the overwhelming needs for mental health assistance in our schools.
Councilmember Doug Plyde responded that Smith's issues are the prerogative of the school district or state education authorities. Another speaker, Renee Miller, made objections that brought objections in turn from Plyde.
The mandates, the things that you are instilling and forcing upon us are harmful. It goes against the Nuremberg Code. It goes against the Oxford epidemiologists. You are causing harm to us as a society, as humans. These are our rights. You're not even following the Constitution. Richard Bolo was recommending vaccinations. These vaccinations aren't even approved by the FDA. They're experimental. And he's saying it's our duty, our duty, our duty. These types of references and false information and
this is character assassination. We're not going to put up with this anymore. If you want to give us technical comments, please do. But we will not put up with character assassination of our employees over the diet.
Robin Openshaw said she is a psychologist and a small business owner.
I find it disingenuous to say we're all in this together when you guys have not taken a hit at all, whereas a lot of us are losing our shirts in business. I think it's disturbing when government employees tell us as business owners that the economy is doing great. The economy is not doing great. And what we've put into place in the last year will be absolutely catastrophic in the coming years. We haven't even begun to see all of the effects, but just go look at the outlet mall. Our economy is being artificially propped up right now by people fleeing from the West Coast because it seems relative to them.
Her wrap-up brought a short response from Council Chairman Glenn Wright.
How about a little respect for the people who want to retain their medical freedom too?
Thank you for your comments, Robin. And I will point out that 500,000 Americans have died from this particular disease. Next speaker, please.
Get the last word in.
However, two speakers supported the COVID mandates. One was Health Board Chairman Chris Cherniak. And Lila Rosenfield, a team leader at the Park City Mountain Resort, supported the restrictions 100%.
And I am quite livid, actually, at the state legislature for tying the county's hands. This mandate was powerful. It was backed by science. And I know that for me and my team at Park City Mountain, having the backing of both a multinational corporation and the state and local government, when we asked people to put up our masks so that we could keep all of us safe, it was a lifesaver. It was a godsend. It was remarkable. So I actually want to ask if there's anything else that we can do. Can we incentivize businesses to continue asking for masks?
Local employee Lila Rosenfield. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Well, the city of Heber and the Heber Airport Flight Path team will be hosting a virtual presentation of the airport's master planning process tonight. They'll be reviewing data and taking questions and input from the public starting at 6 p.m. Under FAA regulations, Heber City cannot restrict planes of any size from landing at the municipal airport. Heber City Manager Matt Brower said the pilots can land based on their judgment. However, he said that the community has spoken out on the airport's future and the impacts it has on residents living nearby.
Yeah, and I think part of the master plan process is to see what we can do as the sponsor of the airport to make sure that we don't do anything to encourage larger aircraft from coming into the airport. And so part of the master plan is hearing from the public to get their ideas, but to make sure that we don't make any investments, again, that would encourage larger aircraft, because the community has spoken and they don't want larger aircraft, but we can't discriminate against anyone that can fly in safely.
The FAA requires a master plan update. The city is also trying to make the airport safer and able to handle future traffic. Brower said the city has no interest in expanding the capacity or allowing larger aircraft to use the airport.
In fact, the two factors that would determine the size of planes that can come in would be the thickness of the runway and the length of the runway. And the city has absolutely zero interest in thickening the runway or lengthening it. And we'll go to the mat to try to prevent that, because we've heard the public and we realize that they don't want those bigger aircraft. And so this is not really about airport expansion. This is really about trying to see what standards the FAA is going to require the city to allow for those C2 aircraft to come in safely. And that's it.
Brower says they'll start the meeting with about a 45-minute presentation, but will stay as late as needed to answer everyone's questions. Again, you can submit questions beforehand, and you can check out HeberValleyFlightPath.com to join the meeting.